Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency.
I'm here today with my client, Andrea Dunlop. Andrea Dunlop is an author and consultant based out of Seattle, Washington, with over a decade and a half of experience in book publishing. She began her career as an in-house publicist for Doubleday, Random House. After moving back to Seattle in 2009, she took over publicity manager for Kim Ricketts Books, book events, promoting a wide range of cookbook and literary events. Next, she spent 5 years with an editorial and book production firm as their executive director of social media and marketing, working with both traditionally and self-published clients and spearheading the company's marketing efforts. Andrea is the author of 3 novels, including Losing the Light, She Regrets Nothing, and We Came Here to Forget, all from Atria, Simon & Schuster. Her books have been featured in Town & Country, Bustle, In Style, Us Weekly, Vanity Fair, People, and elsewhere. In addition to her writing and consulting, Andrea is an accomplished speaker and has presented at book and publishing conferences nationwide. She teaches periodic classes at Hugo House, an arts and literacy organization in Seattle. She is a member of the American Professional Association on the Abuse of Children's Munchausen's by Proxy Committee and is the co-creator of Munchausen Support, which is dedicated to providing resources for frontline professionals, families, and survivors dealing with MBP. So Andrea is a very longtime client of mine, and I'm close with all of my clients, but Andrea and I share a couple of special bonds, which I will let the listener know. One is that we share the same wedding day, August 20th, 2016. Mm-hmm. And we also have a connection. Her book, She Regrets Nothing, came out the week my first son was born. So we always are celebrating milestones together. But thank you for joining me on the podcast, Andrea.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm so excited to be talking to you today. And yeah, I think we have had some really funny moments where our personal lives have tracked along with our professional lives, because it just seems like we're always doing books and babies together. So was just perfectly in sync.
Story of our lives. So on the podcast, I tend to be the one that prattles on and on about comp titles on the podcast. So I put together a little game for us for a little fun start. So for your listeners who don't know about your backlist titles, we're going to kind of learn a little bit about your backlist titles, and I am going to comp your books to you. So I'll give you an example. So, so for the purpose of preparing you, for example, if your book was Red, White, and Royal Blue by Casey McQuiston, I would say, which of your books is American Royals meets The Crown? Or if your book was Eligible by Curtis Sittenfeld, I would say, which of your books is Pride and Prejudice meets The Bachelor, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to give you
two comps. This sounds like a hard game.
No. You're going to get it. I didn't prepare Andrea at all, just so you know. Okay. So
I'm blind.
Okay. So here's your first comps. Which of your books is Bridesmaids meets Lost?
Broken Bay. Oh, I see. We're doing this for my books.
Yes,
I don't have to do this for, I thought I was going to have to do this for just any book. And I was like, oh my God, I don't know. This sounds like the hardest game ever. Okay. All right. I think I can handle it for my books.
Oh,
let's see if I remember what I've actually written.
You know what? Yes, exactly. Okay. Now there's that's Andrea's novella that came out. Her Bridesmaids meets Lost one. Okay. Here's the next Andrea book. Which of your books is The Talented Mr. Ripley meets The Vacationers?
Ooh, Losing the Light.
Yes. Love. Our first book that brought us together. Yeah. Andrea's debut novel. Okay. Which of your books is Great Gatsby meets Downhill Racers meets The Act?
Ooh, that is We Came Here to Forget.
Yes.
You almost got me with that, the Great Gatsby thing. I was like, I think the Great Gatsby is an overarching influence maybe for me.
There's this one scene in the book that I always want to comp Great Gatsby because it has such a Gatsby feel. There's just one big party scene. I won't ruin it for everybody, but the party scene always makes me think of Gatsby. Okay. I think we're our last one. Okay. Which of your books is Gossip Girl meets The Emperor's Children?
Well, that's Sheer Grit's Nothing. And that's the only other book I've read.
There you go. So as I said, I'm just the comp queen. I'm always telling everybody on the podcast, comps. So how do you as a writer feel about comping being compared to other people? Or do you feel like it's just exists in like the publishing part of your world or the writerly part of your world? And like, what do comps, comparative titles and all of that mean to you as a writer?
I think they're so important. And I think that actually learning about comp titles is kind of one of the most important industry things that writers who are not working in any other part of the publishing industry besides being authors, I think that's one of the most important things you can learn about, just because I think that comp titles really are a way of telling you what the book is beyond just the back cover copy description. And they really help place it in the market. And I think they're not a perfect system, but they certainly are a lot more specific than something like genre. I think especially for work like mine, genre just is not very helpful. It doesn't really tell you anything. I mean, there's sort of all of these nebulous genre terms for what I write. Some people call it women's fiction. Some people call it upmarket fiction. Those don't really tell you. Upmarket and women read it. Okay. Women are like the audience for most books. So it doesn't tell you much about it. Right. So we really sort of rely on comp titles to tell a reader what it is. And I think that most readers are looking for what they like. I mean, there's so many books out there. Discovery is always the biggest issue that novelists face. And I think knowing your audience and knowing what other books they're reading, most people who read a lot, they're always looking for something that's like their other favorite books. So I think that's a really good thing to know. It's nice to know how you fit into the market and also sort of how you stand out from that market. So I think that that's kind of it's just a really key thing that I think writers should learn about as much as possible.
Thank you. Thank you for giving a pitch for comp titles.
Well, yeah. And I think it's also important that it sort of speaks to the importance of doing a lot of reading. I know that some authors really don't like to read a lot of books like theirs while they're in the writing process, sort of just that anxiety of influence, if you will. But I think as much as you can, sort of knowing the other books in the market and knowing what else your readers are into, and also for the purposes of supporting your community and supporting fellow writers, I think that's really important too. And that's something that's the best way to get to know your comps is just to read a lot.
Absolutely. So one of the fun things I did to prepare for my talk with Andrea was I crowdsourced some questions for her on my Instagram stories. So I said, interviewing Andrea Dunlop, what do you want to know? And so we got some really good questions. So here's the first one. Some of them were repeats, so I could tell what's on everybody's mind. And this is a really big one. There's a lot of anxiety around this. And writers want to know, what is it like to be on submissions to editors, right? So there's this whole, like, you know, getting an agent thing, but what does it feel like when you're on submission to editors, kind of the next step of getting the book deal?
It feels like you've just met a guy or gal or non-binary individual that you are really, really into, and you are waiting for them to call you. It is probably the hardest part of the entire process. It's the most passive part of the process for writers. There's nothing you can do. At that point, you have done all your work. You have prepped with your agent. Your agent has sent out his or her pitches. And you're just waiting by the phone. And you're waiting for that call that's going to, you know, move your life forward or not happen. And then when it's not happening, it feels like death by a thousand paper cuts. It's really, really hard. I think it's an exciting place to be because you're really on the brink, but it is the most, I think for myself and for every writer I know, this is the most difficult part of the process because all you can do is sit and wait. The thing that I always try and do is start on another project to sort of deal with the emotional ups and downs of the actual publishing process versus the writing process. I really, like most writers, I think prefer to be in that writing zone. That's where we're happiest. When you're on submission with a novel in particular, you can't really start another novel necessarily because any day, you know, you could be on submission for a week or you could be on submission for a year. You don't know what your time period is going to be. And so to sort of try and dive into a new project that you may or may not be able to keep up momentum on is pretty hard. So I think it's just a matter of trying to distract yourself. I have to say right now, I think the only hack I can advise on is that, you know, this past year or so, I've had a fiction project, a nonfiction project, and a podcast that I've been working on. So I've had these sort of three creative projects that have been important to me. And I have noticed that it is helpful to sort of spread it out a little bit. You can kind of like pivot. That's not necessarily a practical thing to do all the time. But I think as much as you can sort of find something else to distract yourself with that's creative, but maybe not the whole next book, it is probably the best thing you can do. But yeah, submission is really hard.
Okay, here's our next question. What is the best marketing and publicity advice writers normally never get?
Ooh, that's a good one. I mean, probably all of it. I feel like this is a place where there's just a real gap in terms of preparing writers for what they're going to be dealing with when their book goes on sale. Luckily for me, I had a background in publishing and on the marketing side in particular. So I knew what to expect. And I think that has helped me a lot. And Carly, you're really excellent in terms of knowing about social media, in terms of being proactive with marketing efforts, but that's not every agent's wheelhouse. And so I think a lot of authors don't get prepped by anybody on what they're supposed to be doing. And there's sort of a lot of general talk about, oh, you should be proactive. Oh, we want you to be on social media. We want you to be promoting your book, but there's not a lot of on the ground advice for what that looks like. And I think a lot of authors feel really surprised by that. They're surprised by how much they're expected to do. They don't feel prepared for that. And there's a reality that you can spend your creative energies, you know, you only have so much in the bank. So I think a lot of writers, a lot of our creative energy goes towards our actual work. And then there can be a sort of level of exhaustion of trying to do social media and all these other things. So my best advice is to take that proactive role and just find something that feels really manageable. So maybe that's a monthly newsletter, or maybe that's one social media platform that you happen to like. If you find TikTok fun, there's lots of ways to do, you know, book talk. And I'm sort of just starting to get into that. I'm an elder millennial, so it's not exactly, doesn't feel completely automatic to me, but it is fun. Or Instagram, or it doesn't really matter what the tactic is. I think a lot of authors feel like because they get this blanket advice to use social media that they need to use all these different platforms. Find one good way to connect with your audience directly and focus your energies on that and then build on that. So you need to pick a tactic that you have the time for and that you can actually sustain, and then kind of just let the rest of that noise fall away because nobody can do it all. Nobody can do it all of the time. And it really takes time. I mean, I think that's the other thing is that people get really focused on the book launch, but it's really about your whole career. And most of the tactics that you have any control over are going to be things that you're going to build for your whole career. So things like building up a mailing list or building up a following on social media.
Yeah, a lot of it is that long-term vision, right? Everybody's thinking this book right now, what do I do today on social media? But it's such a long game of like the career, the newsletter, the mailing list, like everything, right? It builds and builds and builds in a long career.
Yeah, and I think it's really helpful sometimes when you have a book that you read that you really like, or it's a book that is getting a lot of attention, that's a breakout book. Sometimes that's a debut. Every once in a while, there'll just be a debut that really gets like loaded for bear and is the one that a publisher really puts all its resources into. But more often, that's that author's third, fourth, fifth book. So maybe that's the first book you've read by that author, but check out their ad card. And then you find out, oh, which is that little piece of the front matter that says all their other books, and come to find out it's their fifth or sixth book. And that I think is always a little bit calming to think like, okay, this feels like, from my perspective, it happened overnight for this person, but it definitely did.
Okay, next question. Why did you leave working in publishing?
Well, I wouldn't say that I've left working in publishing entirely. It's sort of, you know, I don't have an office day job anymore. Frankly, that was not something that I liked. So I was pretty anxious to get away from that. There are some things I really miss about working in an office and sort of working with other people, but I more or less just went freelance around the time that my first book came out. That just was more manageable. And certainly in the meantime, I've gotten married and had kids and or had a child. And that certainly also complicates the having an office job part of things. Basically, I just sort of think of my two sides of my work as sort of dials that I dial up and dial back. Some years I'm doing more consulting and more teaching, and then some years I'm doing more writing. So that's been a mix that's worked really well. And I really like to keep a little bit of a toe in the publishing world, whether that's teaching classes at Hugo House or doing some consulting. It's nice to sort of keep that part of my brain sharp. Having a full-time day job and being a writer at the same time, that's where almost all of us start, right? You certainly write your first novel while you have a full-time day job, almost certainly. But that does become hard. I mean, it really does become hard to sort of keep up with that. So I think that's why a lot of people you see end up sort of in more in the freelance space.
Well, I love that analogy of like dialing up and dialing down. I think everybody can relate to that. And also talking about long careers, right? Like if you're going to do this job for a long time, there's going to be, we are not even getting into the financials of publishing on this talk, but there's going to be years where it's like, we're up or down, right? And like to have that dial up, dial down factor with subsidiary income is just so important for writers to kind of manage that balance, which.
Yeah. And I think it's really good to have a trade, so to speak. I mean, it's really good to have something else you can do for money. I think it's not a bummer to have to do some other kind of work. I mean, I think that's just the reality for almost all writers. There's a very, very small percentage of people that are only living off that income.
Okay. Next question. Anything you wish you started doing earlier in your career?
You know, I don't think so. I really think like there are certainly things that I have learned to do differently as I've gone along, but I think the value of those lessons was also really important. So I started off with my first book, just like throwing everything possible against the wall. And I've sort of like, I'm very much into experimenting in terms of how to reach readers and how to control my end of it, right? There's always a lot you can't control if you're working in traditional publishing. You know, a lot of it is down to your publisher, but I think there are various like different kinds of events, different kinds of social media strategies that I've tried that have not all of them have flown, but I think I've learned a lot along the way. And so I don't know that I would really do anything differently or there's anything I kind of wish I'd started earlier. I mean, I think you always wish that you were the first person to discover the next social media that was going to be really big. Because if you were like one of the first authors to get really big into Instagram, which I wasn't, or one of the first big, you know, authors to get into whatever it is, which I wasn't, because that's like, that takes a prescience that like most of us don't have. And I think that's kind of a luck of the draw thing. Other than being, than wishing I was one of the first Instagram people so that I would have 100,000 followers or whatever. I was really well set up from working in publishing. I think that really helped me a lot. And yeah, I think everything I've learned along the way has been valuable.
Absolutely. Okay. I had a lot of questions about your writing process. Everybody wants to know, and you talked a little bit about how you have different projects going on right now, but can you give us just like from the big picture to the day to day, like what does your writing process actually look like?
Oh my goodness. I feel like this is such a hard one to answer. And it's one that all writers get asked a lot. So I would say for fiction, in terms of process, with the question of being, as we say, a plotter or a pantser, Some writers really do a lot of prep work in terms of making an outline and all kinds of notes before they sit down to write. And then some of us just sit down with some kind of idea and start writing. And I am definitely the latter. I'm definitely a pantser. One of the great joys of writing for me is just to have some hint of an idea. You know, sometimes I really have a novel, sort of the whole thing in my head when I sit down to write. That definitely happened with We Came Here to Forget. I think that was because it really came from such a more personal place where there was like some business I wanted to attend to there. And so that sort of came out in a really different way than my other books. But I think in general, I usually have sort of one compelling character or even one compelling scene that's sort of giving me that feeling of wanting to chase it and write 90,000 incredibly messy words about that and just follow the various, you know, go down the various rabbit holes that takes me. And that's a really, I love writing a first draft. I think it's so much fun to just be sort of not self-conscious and not even thinking about the reader yet, just sort of sitting and letting it come out. I sort of think of it as, I think it's the Scottish myth. And I know this because of the movie Brave that my daughter's obsessed with, where they chase the will-o'-the-wisps. Like that's kind of like my process for writing novels. I'm like, whoo, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I'm going to follow it. We just sold our first nonfiction project together. That was such a different experience. And it's been so fun to do something that so different from novel writing, because, you know, when you're writing a nonfiction project, you don't sell it based on a manuscript, you sell it based on a book proposal. For those of us who don't know what goes into that, so you have an outline, you have chapter summaries, you have an overview, you have a marketing section. So it's basically this business plan for what your book is going to be. And you're really thinking about the structure and how the book is going to come together and who the reader is. You're necessarily thinking about these things before you really get into writing a lot of the manuscript, you write a few chapters. So that's been really interesting to sort of take that different lens. And also to, of course, to be working with facts. That's different. I'm like, oh, you know, so you really can't, like, other than, you know, tweaking dialogue here and there and taking the small bits of artistic license, you really can't, you don't want to make things up if you have a nonfiction book. In terms of my sort of daily process, that's something that's sort of ever shifting too. I think before I had my daughter, I was, and in some periods after, since I've had her, I'm usually a morning writer. I usually really like to have that be the first thing I do. So if my daughter's still sleeping, or again, before I had her, when I had a day job, I would get up before work. And that's been really key for me. I don't know how people sit down and write at the end of the day. I certainly don't have anything to give it at that time. I know for some people, that's a great time to sort of, after their day is done and their family's asleep, they go down and write. I certainly couldn't do that. So yeah, I like to have it be the first thing I do, you know, get out of bed. Honestly, I don't do anything before I go get a cup of coffee and I sit down and write. I mean, it's gross. I don't brush my teeth. I'm in my pajamas. Like I'm just full feral, like morning person, like don't want anyone to interact with me. And that feels really nice. And, you know, that's what I did throughout the sort of shutdown parts of the pandemic when I was watching my daughter all day. So I didn't really have time to write during the day and I would get up in the morning. And that was really nice. There's just something that's really nice about having that space to yourself in the morning and sort of before you read the very scary news and before you have your energy siphoned off by your beloved toddler. You know, it's like to have that mental space was really, has always been something that I've really, really loved. And I am not a natural morning person. My husband is. It's very annoying. He just like wakes up before six and is like, that's his like best time of day. He gets out of bed really easily. This is a habit that I've had to force on myself, but it is one that has really served me well. So yes, is that kind of enough of a answer for my
Instagram? Process? Instagram will tell us if we covered that. But yes. Obviously,
yeah, and I love Instagram. So if you anybody who wants to reach out to me on Instagram with publishing questions, whether it's about my books or your books or whatever, I always love to talk to folks. So feel free to reach out.
Yes, yes, and she's wonderful.
My DMs are open.
Yes, and she doesn't have 100,000 followers, but you do have like 8 or 10. Like you got a good amount. So
yeah, I mean, it's getting there. And I think it's always good to focus on, like, I feel like I have good followers. I feel like I have a good community there. And it's like great bookish people, readers and bookstagrammers and stuff. So it's also, it's not all about the numbers. That's another good actually piece of social media advice is not to get too focused on just definitely those metrics.
Yeah, no, I love that you're just able to curate a community on there. Like that's my favorite thing about it, right? Like they come to you and they stick around for you and it's your community that you build, and so much better than gross Twitter.
Yeah, no, I don't even go on Twitter anymore.
Okay, I got one last question from the Instagrammers for you, which is, maybe you can, I don't know, pull out some heartfelt wisdom here, but advice for somebody who thinks they quote unquote failed at NaNoWriMo.
Oh, I love this question. So NaNoWriMo or NaNoWriMo or however we pronounce it is the goal is, I think, 50,000 words in 1 month, which is a lot of words in 1 month. I think that if you feel like you failed at NaNoWriMo, which I'm assuming that you did not reach that 50,000, that would be the failure. How many words did you end up with? Did you end up with 20,000 or 10,000? That's still a lot in a month. That's still a really good clip. And I think it's the oldest advice in writing, but it is the best, that writing is about putting your butt in your chair. And so if that helped you put your butt in your chair and get anything on paper, then that's a start and it's something you build off of. And I think that it's really important with NaNoWriMo or any other sort of goal setting around writing to keep the spirit of it in mind and not get too attached to the letter of the law there, because the spirit of NaNoWriMo is supposed to be, we are going to sit down and do this thing. They set that lofty word count goal because it will keep people from self-editing. It will keep people from getting self-conscious. And I think that that's a really good spirit to take with you on your first draft. You know, I talked about how I write first drafts, which is like, I just let it be the most glorious mess that it wants to be. I will follow any bonkers rabbit hole in case there's something good there. Like, I mean, I think with my last novel, I cut at least 100,000 words, ended up on the cutting room floor as I was writing various revisions. So I think like take the spirit of NaNoWriMo with you as you continue on that draft, which is just like, just get the words on the page. Doesn't matter if they're good words, bad words, like that's what revision is for. Like first drafts are supposed to be ugly. So I think like, don't get obsessed with reaching that goal. I think goal setting is good, but also reevaluating goals as you go is better, because I think like goals only matter insofar as they keep you motivated. If they start to make you feel defeated, then you're working at cross purposes with your goals. So yeah, figure out why maybe you weren't able to reach that 50,000. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons, right? Like that's a lot of words. Like writing takes this very small space in our lives, realistically, time-wise for most of us, especially if you're working on a first draft and you don't have a contract yet. Then you're not able to sort of like, I know I sort of talked about dialing up these day job and writing work. Like there's a lot of writing that all of us do on spec, right? We aren't necessarily going to get reimbursed for that time. So you really do have to like cut yourself some slack. We all have lives. We have day jobs and kids and friends and family members that need our help. Obviously this last 2 years has been an incredibly, whatever it is, almost 2 years, has been an incredibly hard time. So cut yourself some slack and keep the spirit going and find goals that are going to keep you motivated and not make you feel bad.
I think that's wonderful advice. So whether you quote unquote win or quote unquote lose at NaNoWriMo, NaNoWriMo, yeah, I think you're a winner in my books because I don't write. I'm an agent.
Me too. You're a winner in my book just for sitting down and opening the Word document and giving it a try. Yeah.
Would you ever do it?
I have in the past tried. I don't think I've ever tried to get the 50,000 because I just wasn't necessarily like at that point of working on something. You sort of have to be like sitting down to write a first draft on November 1st or kind of like really early in a first draft to want to get that 50,000. If you're working on a revision, then you're not going to like pile up 50,000 words. But I do usually in November try and hop on social media and like chat with people about NaNoWriMo. I love watching people do it. I kind of absorb the energy of, again, the spirit of the thing, right? Which is like people supporting each other and cheering each other on and really just that real focus on getting words on the page. So yeah, and I do set those kind of goals for myself sometimes, especially, you know, in that first draft mode where I'm like, okay, I'm going to get 1,000 words a day or 2,000 words a day or whatever it is. The word count thing can be a really good goal to just keep your momentum up, which is really important on a first draft. I mean, I think it's really hard to get 80 or 90,000 words down. It's just something that a lot of people can't do. So
absolutely. Well, that's all the questions that we had from Instagrammers. So thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, sharing all of your wisdom. I'm sure people will be quote tweeting lots of inspirational quotes from your chat. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, it was such a pleasure.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky, though, to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 2nd of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 3rd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com, look for the beta reader matchup page, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Today's guest is the author of 6 previous novels in the Peter Ash series, most recently The Breaker. His debut, The Drifter, won both the ITW Thriller Award and the Barry Award for Best First Novel, and was a finalist for the Edgar, Anthony, and Hammett Awards. A husband and father, he lives in Milwaukee. It's my pleasure to welcome Nick Petrie. Nick, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Bianca. I've been listening to your podcast for quite a while now, so it's quite a joy to be on it. Thank you.
Right. So you know from listening to the podcast that we dive right in, and there are some elements of craft that I really want to pick your brain about today. But before we get into that, just for our listeners, the book we're talking about today is The Runaway. The blurb for the book is, when Peter Ash rescues a stranded woman, he finds she's in far deeper trouble than he could ever imagine. Working nights at a gas station in an isolated Montana town, Helene is desperate to escape both her low-paying job and her predatory boss. So when a kind stranger stops to fill up his tank, Helene barely hesitates before asking for a ride, willing to go anywhere to start her life over. But she may have fled one danger only to run straight into another. Dun, dun, dun. So lots of page-turning action here. I actually got to interview Mark Graney earlier this week about his latest book. So for me, it's been a real treat reading two male authors, all this action and tension and intrigue intrigue and suspense back to back. So that's been lovely. So Nick, something that I want to specifically focus on today is beginnings, because on the podcast, we try and give writers rules, more guidelines to say, these are the kind of things that ensure a good beginning. And we say, try and do this, try and avoid that. Now, one of the things we suggest they do is have inner and outer conflict. So you want to see a character struggling with something internally. We want to see them struggling with something externally. We want to show them in a moment of crisis and sort of taking it from there. And something we tell them to avoid is backstory. Now, can you tell us about these three opening chapters just to give our readers a bit of context on them?
Well, sure. We meet Helene at her job working nights at a remote gas station / grocery store at the far west edge of the Great Plains. And she's all alone. This is a tiny little town. She's down to two people, and one of whom is her predatory boss, who's also her landlord, who's also a county sheriff's deputy. So he has far more power over her than anybody should. And we get a sense of where she is in her life, and we get a sense of the threat that he poses to her. And then this stranger shows up to fill his gas tank and keep heading on his way. And he's kind to her, and that doesn't happen a lot in her life. And so she decides very quickly, has to decide very quickly, that if she is going to get out of this position, she's got no family, she's got nobody else to help her, that she's got to take advantage of this moment. And so she walks out and she asks this stranger if he'll give her a ride. And, you know, as it turns out, he's not alone. He has a friend in the car. And so that adds somewhat to the tension. But, you know, one of the things about writing this character is we're very deep inside her inner life. And so she has not so much inner conflict, I would say, as multiple kinds of outer conflict. And she has a real strong need, and she's trying hard to figure out how to get out of there. It's funny. One of the things that I love about what you do, Bianca, is that you talk about the technical details of how writing gets done. And for me, I am operating entirely by feel. I'm a pantser. I just begin. I'm looking for a voice. You know, really, that is how I begin and how this book began, was Helene kind of started talking to me. And I just tried to follow where she wanted to go or where she had to go. So I'm not sure that's a very writerly answer for you, but I do think that that's sort of how my process works.
Very much is a writerly answer. You know, for most of us, some character taps us on the shoulder. It's like talking to a stranger at a bar, and they're like, sit down, I'm going to tell you all of my stuff and you're going to listen. So that's how it happens for me as well. But I disagree with you in terms of Helene's inner conflict, because she has quite a lot of inner conflict. You know, when he first arrives, she's got a lot of interiority, like you say. It's written in the third person, yet it's super, super close to her. You know, we're very, very close to her. And there's things that she wants to say, but she doesn't say. There's things she kind of blurts out and then wishes she didn't. She's so used to men objectifying her that she's kind of testing the stranger. You know, he's not staring at her boobs like most men do when they come into the gas station, etc. So, you know, there's a lot happening inside of her. And when she decides to go with him, there is this conflict. She's like, should I do it? Should I not do it? This is my opportunity to make a run for it. So we definitely see the inner push and pull within her. And we see all this external conflict in her life, which definitely makes her super compelling. The thing that really interested me is, you know, I say to our listeners that the beginnings of stories is like circling a building. You're just trying to find your way in. Sometimes it's the front door, sometimes it's the back door, sometimes it's a fire escape. There's always so many different ways to begin a story, and you begin in the action. She is in this gas station. She's actually sleeping and the stranger wakes her up, and we get a sense of how exhausted she is, the long hours she works, etc. And he isn't like other men. He doesn't treat her the same way. He's not disrespectful of her. He hasn't objectified her, and this kind of intrigues her. And then in chapter 2, we go back and we have her backstory with this deputy, with her mother passing away, with her working these long hours, and this guy is super creepy, and he's what? He's waiting for her 19th birthday. Why?
Well, he is playing a game with her, or he thinks he's playing a game. For her, it's deadly serious. For him, it's like foreplay. And he is letting her know and enjoying the tension it creates in her that, you know, his control over her is growing and growing, and that she should either give in to him or he will take what he wants regardless. And he is essentially given her the deadline of her 19th birthday, which is rapidly approaching. But I don't know, the backstory question is really interesting because I'm really interested in backstory. I'm really interested in why people become the way they are. And I know it's sort of a commonplace trope to sort of say who you were in your childhood is who you are, dictates who you become as an adult. Although I think there's some truth to that. And I also think what makes it interesting is what are the ways that you resist your backstory? What are the ways that you push against it to try to become, you know, your own person, to define yourself as opposed to having your history define you? And so those are all the things that I'm kind of interested in talking about in terms of character.
It also, no, it explains her motivation so well. So the only reason I ask about it is because you did it so well. So I normally say to my students and listeners, no backstory within the first three chapters. Ground us in the here and now and let's go. And you did that in the first chapter. Chapter two, you give us that backstory so that we understand why Helene would grab some things out of the gas station, grab some money out of the till, and go with two strange men because she's so desperate to get out of there. So it completely explains her motivation. My question is, when you decided to structure it this way, is there a reason why you didn't begin, let's say, 2 days earlier or a day earlier, and then we moved on to the stranger? For me, it's always just interesting the decisions we make in how we are going to present the order of events to our listeners, because there's no right way, there's no wrong way, there's just the way we chose. And so that's what I'm trying to do, is understand your rationale in terms of beginning where you did, then going back to backstory, and then bringing us back to the present moment again, as opposed to a linear timeline with her, like the day before, seeing this creepy guy, knowing her 19th birthday is approaching, and then seeing the scene in the gas station unfolding.
You know, I have no idea how to answer that question. I wish I could have sort of planned out how that chapter evolved. And I rewrote it half a dozen times, probably. I guess I'm looking for a certain sort of narrative shape. And I do like to begin in the middle, as Elmore Leonard said, and as you advise your students. I think that's a good idea, to begin where something is happening. But you also kind of know what informs what's happening. So, you know, I place her in that gas station and, you know, you see her in conflict with her circumstances and somewhat with herself. No, I suppose you're right that it's because she has all of these impulses within her, because what person in their right mind would climb into a, what woman certainly would climb into a car with two strange men? And so I had to give her a good reason. And I had to have sort of that push and pull at the same time. But, you know, I'm always interested when writers talk about their choices as if they had other choices. And for me, I am just following what feels to me like the inevitability of how things should be in my head. The last podcast of yours I listened to, this is a cardinal sin for an author, but I can't remember your guest's name. But she talked about having a W structure. And I love that idea, but I could never begin something thinking about what sort of structure it would need. I really just sort of follow it down to see what happens. And I've read thousands and thousands of books of all sorts. And those are the things that I think you, after a while, you begin to internalize those structures and those systems. And you just think in terms of your story. At least that's what I do. Instead of trying to impose something externally on it, I just try to follow and to feel what this story wants to be. And it is a messy process. It is not efficient in any way. I wish, in fact, that I could be an outliner. I wish I could be like, you know, Mark Graney, who is a friend of mine and who is a really, really productive author. I wish I could generate as much work as he does. But I am, you know, for me, it is just I'm sort of feeling my way forward. I wrote a piece in Crime Reads about how, for me, writing is like exploring a cave in the dark without a headlamp. I'm just really kind of feeling my way through, trying to figure out what the best way to do this is. And for me, it's not a rational process per se. It's really intuitive.
Yeah. And you've intuitively come at it the best possible way, because, you know, I was looking at these three chapters, trying to move them around as puzzle pieces. And it's amazing how we begin the chapter, we see Helene and she's kind of snarky, you know, she's like, I don't give a shit about what's in the store. Take the shit. You don't have to pay for it. You know, she's kind of got attitude and we're not 100% on board with her. And we see her kind of looking at this guy, trying to make a decision, and we would automatically be like, hell no, don't go there. And then in one chapter, you give us, I think it's like, and it's a short chapter for our listeners, it's like three pages or so of her backstory, and we are like immediately 100% invested in her based on that backstory. We are rooting for her so that when she makes this decision to go with the men, we realize that it's like it's major catch 22 because she's screwed if she stays. And she's definitely screwed if she stays. But if she goes with this man, there's a slight chance that she isn't screwed. So we are kind of rooting for her. So it was, you know, a wonderful decision that you made instinctively. For emerging writers, they're still trying to find their way into that instinctual kind of process where they just know something feels right, which is why we try and pick it apart and go, why did you do this? Maybe there was a rational reason for it.
Well, no, all that makes sense to me. And certainly when I was starting out, I kind of worked the same way to some extent. I have a master's in fine arts and fiction. I've been through a million workshops. I've, you know, run a million workshops. It's a different, working on short stories is also kind of a fundamentally different process. But I do think that the goal is to internalize your story process. And I've had the privilege of interviewing lots of authors at my local bookstore and for other events. And Greg Hurwitz, who's another thriller writer, one of his lines, which I love, he says people always ask him what the right book to read is so that they'll learn how to write fiction. And he said, well, there's no one right book. There's about 2,000 that you should read. And I think that's absolutely true because, I mean, reading is really the best way to learn to write. You certainly want to examine your prose. You want to write something and then take it apart and see what works and what doesn't. But you really need to read and you need to, you know, read above yourself, right? If what you love is a good potboiler thriller, you should try reading stuff that is a level or two above that so that you can hopefully, you know, learn from people who are better than you. And so I think that's kind of where that instinct gets developed for writers.
Yeah, 100%. And every writer's process is different. The author you were talking about is Fiona Davis. She was talking about that W structure. She writes historical fiction. I'm like you, I'm a complete pantser. And, you know, every book is different. It's a puzzle. And you as the author have got to figure out how the damn hell to put the thing together. And it's going to be different to the last puzzle you put together. And that's part of the joy and part of the fun of writing it. Now, let's talk again about the chapters that happen after that. You've got so much action. And I understand that this is an action thriller, but the story just moves forward so beautifully and so seamlessly. After we see Helene with these guys, we've got an instance where Peter comes across this woman who's parked on the side of the road. She's heavily pregnant and she's clearly running away from something. And being the kind of guy he is, he steps in to help her. And you keep the chapters really short and you always finish with something that keeps people reading pages. Again, is this something that you've adopted as your technique? Or again, do you just instinctively write a chapter and you end it at a place where you instinctively feel like that's a good end? Or do you have like a formula for yourself?
Well, I often write forward and there are natural breaks in where, you know, there's a shift or where I want to jump forward in time a little bit. And I'll often write 5,000 words or more without really breaking up into chapters. And then I will go back and sort of say, well, my chapters, again, I'm shooting for somewhere between 1,200 words and 1,600 words, because I think that's a good, as a reader, I think that's a good sort of consumable chunk that's not exhausting. And I've noticed that when I'm reading something, if it's 11 o'clock at night and I should have turned the light out at 10:30, but the next chapter is just a couple pages and it ends at a little bit of a tension point, then I will often keep turning the pages. So I am a little bit deliberate about that, but I think of that as a different process than that discovery process. So for me, there's the bashing out that draft, and then there are the more, which for me is utterly instinctual. And then there are those points where, you know, I kind of have to pull back and sort of say, okay, what have I done? And what shape has it taken? And what should I do with that? And so chapters and ends of chapters are very much something I'll test it out. I'll make a break. I'll write chapter and then I'll go forward and I'll shift them around. Or I'll have a chapter section that's 2,500 words and then the next one that's 800 words. And I'll think, okay, how can I balance these out a little bit? And I think part of it is when you are writing thrillers, right? That's my publisher. That's what my publisher calls these. The focus is on having tension on every page and on having fun, right? It should be exciting. Even if it's something that's not very pleasant that's happening, it should be exciting, right? I'm going for a physical reaction. And I can tell when I'm writing if my heartbeat is elevated. If I'm writing a scene that is engaging me emotionally, it also engages you physically. And that's why when you're at the very end of a really good, exciting book, it's hard to go to sleep afterward, right? So that's that effect that I'm going for. And the line or the moment at the end of a chapter is something I do spend some effort on. Sometimes it just happens, but sometimes I have to kind of go, yeah, I need to play with that a little bit. I need to add something to that a little bit. But yeah, it's a funny process because there is the instinctual piece, and then there's the place where the writer shows up. I'm not quite sure who the other person is, but then the writer shows up and starts to sort of say, okay, now, you know, what do you have? And I'm often switching back and forth, which can be problematic. When I begin a workday, I'll go with the previous few days' work, and I'll kind of go through to fall into that voice and to sort of clean things up. Because when it does start to come, I sometimes need to sort of pull out some of the emotional bits a little bit, or I need to clarify some of the action pieces a little bit. So I spend the sort of the first part of my morning cleaning up and enhancing and developing what I've done the last few days, which is not so much instinctual. That's really analytical. And then I'll just try to push the book forward by not thinking too much. So it's an interesting back and forth. And I think you have to get good at using both those sets of muscles.
Yeah, very much so. And it sounds like our process is exactly the same. I also begin by going over the last few days' work, cleaning that up, and then I go forward. And, you know, for our listeners, it's a great way to immerse yourself back in this world, in the voice that you've chosen, whether it's a narrative voice or point of view, etc. And I always feel more comfortable moving forward once I'm happy with what I've just finished. So the more polished my previous chapter is, the more confident I feel moving forward. So that's a technique I definitely recommend as well. Last question before I have to let you go, Nick. Who is your reader? Like when you think of your demographic, I mean, you obviously do a ton of events at bookstores, etc. Can you tell us who your average reader is, or is it that your demographic's quite wide?
Well, my demographic is quite wide. That's one of the things that my publisher finds interesting is for the typical thriller demographic is often an older than middle-aged white guy. And my demographic is actually more female than male. And I think that's the emphasis on character is part of what has brought that second audience. But it's also spread fairly evenly from the youngest demographic, the youngest adult demographic, that is, through the oldest. And I'm not quite sure entirely why that is. But in terms of who I think of as my reader, I'm essentially writing for my wife. And the reason I lean into character is because that's what she's interested in. And if I want her to read my draft, it has to be something that she wants to read. And I think when I get stuck, sometimes writing the beginning, back to the bit about how to start something, sometimes I have trouble finding that beginning. This book, I wrote three different beginnings to three different books. And I finally came back to that first one because I was writing to all the readers, right? And trying to write something that would appeal to all of the readers. And really, that's not a successful strategy because it essentially empties the work of any personality. It empties the work of any heart or soul. And so it really helps me to kind of remember that I am really just writing for one person. And I'm trying to find a way to convey the story that I want to tell to somebody who has a certain aesthetic, which is not that different from my own. But it's easy, especially as a series grows. So this is the seventh book in this series, and the readership is growing quite a bit. And it's easy to get sort of lost in the idea of the audience. So again, I'm really writing for one person.
And that very much comes through. You write women really well. You wrote Helene incredibly, incredibly well. And that is, you know, why you have a big female audience, because they connect with that. So continue having your wife as your first reader. She's an excellent person to write for. So Nick, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us. I mean, I know I really broke down those opening chapters, but there was so much that we could have discussed in the book. So for our listeners, we're putting the book, The Runaway, on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you buy it through there, you're supporting an independent bookstore, which is always wonderful. You're supporting an author, which is always wonderful. And you are supporting the podcast, which we greatly appreciate. And that's it for today's episode. If you have any questions about writing or publishing, please email me at theshitaboutwriting@gmail.com, and I'll do my best to get them answered for you. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.